Let's start in the very beginning, all right? In the beginning, God creates all things. You've got Adam and Eve, you've got the first man, first woman in the garden, and Genesis 2 tells us that in the very beginning, the man and his wife were both naked and they felt no shame. Lived in a perfect environment, perfect garden, perfect place, and no sin. But then they sinned by eating from the tree that God had instructed them not to eat. And in Genesis 3, after they'd sinned, the eyes of both were opened, and they realized that they were naked. And so they sewed fig leaves together, and they made coverings for themselves. There was no sin before, and there was no shame. But now after they sinned, they now feel shame. And in the very next verse, it says that the man and his wife heard the sound of God as he was walking in the garden in the cool of day, and they hid from God among the trees. They went behind the trees within the garden, hiding, and then God calls out to them, "Where are you?" Sin brings shame and then leads them to hide. We do the same thing. We run from God thinking that he's going to come after us, trying to catch us, that he's looking for us to punish us. We think that he's searching for us, trying to catch us in some sort of a trap, like he's trying to sneak up on us. And so we try to hide from him. We try to keep him at arm's length, just out of his reach, which is kind of a ridiculous thing to do, trying to hide from God. That's kind of strange. It's kind of like when you're holding a baby and you're playing like peekaboo with them, and they cover their eyes and they think that means that you can't see them, right? They're kind of confusing. But you play along because, you know, you're a good adult, and so you play along with them like you've suddenly lost them, like you can't find them. That's what we do with God. We close our eyes towards him. We pretend that he can't see us. And in Genesis 3, it looks almost like God plays along. So we tell ourselves things like, God's going to get you. He's looking for you. He's chasing you. He's gonna find you, and you're going to get it, right? You're not worthy of forgiveness. You don't deserve a second chance. If you go back to the garden in Genesis, the very plain truth of the story is this: God is searching for Adam and Eve. Now, is he looking for them to catch them, or is there something else causing his pursuit? Go back to when you were young, elementary school, and go back to the day that, you know, if you were a girl, you didn't like the boys because they had cooties. Remember that? And if you were a boy, you didn't like the girls either because they also had cooties. Like, everybody had it, right? And you remember, like, playing on the playground. You're playing tag. And if you're a boy, if a girl tagged you, that was, like, the worst thing that could happen in your day. Ruined it, right? If you were a girl and a boy came along, you didn't want to play with him. If he tagged them, man, that was the worst thing in the world. But then something changes in, like, fourth or fifth grade. Do you remember? Suddenly those girls with cooties are the ones that you wished were chasing you. The boys with the cooties, you wish that they were chasing you. Kind of switches up, doesn't it? And you go from trying not to be caught to actually, you know, kind of wanting to be caught. Maybe you run a little bit slower, right? This week we were talking about this in our preaching call, and Randy, who you guys know, he's Doc's preaching partner. He's my friend, but he's Doc's preaching partner. He was telling me in his youth about at their high school that they had a thing called a Sadie Hawkins dance. You might be familiar with that, right? It's a dance where the girls ask the guys. It's always a surprise. Anyway, he told me how his school would do this. They would release the boys out into this yard on the side of the school, and then the girls would be released to go catch them, which sounds absolutely terrifying to me on so many levels, right? But they went out, and if a girl catches you, then you're the one that she's taking to the dance. Like, I would have nightmares about that day in school. That would be awful. Can you remember a time that when you were running from someone, something, but there's also someone that you would slow down for, something that you'd slow down for so that it could catch you? Have you ever moved from wanting to escape to actually wanting to be caught? God chases us. And you may think that's true. Maybe you've believed that for a long time. Maybe you've thought that he's been trying to catch you for some time and not for nice reasons. That there's this idea that God is after you and he's going to catch you and eventually you're going to pay the price, right? There's a surprising characteristic about God that might be a brand new thought for you. The reason God chases you is because he wants to extend grace. He's chasing you down to give you grace. He's not trying to serve a warrant so you can face the consequences of your sin or your shame or your guilt. God is chasing you with grace. Said it last week, Doc and I are using a book called Grace is Greater, written by Kyle Idleman. And we talked about it last week. We're not preaching the book, but we're using some of the really big ideas. And he has this quote in here that's just phenomenal. Kyle says, the worst thing that could happen is that you spend your life trying to outrun God because you think he's chasing you to collect what you owe when he's really chasing you to give you what you could never afford. Man, that's a huge idea. And it can change your life. You can run away and hide, but grace is relentless. Grace will chase you down. And maybe one of the more surprising parts of it, and something that we're going to look at very closely today, is that when it catches you, it's kind of like tag, you're it. It's kind of like it's your turn, that it's not just for you. It's kind of like cooties. It's supposed to spread. So let me show you a time when this plays out with Jesus. It unfolds in John chapter 4, early in Jesus' ministry, and he's starting to gain some steam. There's a crowd that's kind of starting to grow and follow him. They're kind of gaining some movement, and that means that it also starts creating some tension. So Jesus decides that he's kind of got to leave the area that he's at. He's got to go somewhere else to let things kind of cool back down. So he leaves the region that he's in. It's in Judea, and I know that doesn't mean anything to you. Imagine Florida, all right? And so like he's in Florida, but he's got to get out because it's tension's growing. It's also Florida, so you want to get out. And so he comes back to Kentucky, goes up to Galilee. And we're told that as Jesus is leaving the area, he had to go through Samaria, which would be kind of like saying that you have to go through Tennessee to get back up to Kentucky, which is true, but it's not like absolutely true. It's not really true, like absolutely. You don't have to go through Tennessee. It's the quickest way to get there, but like you kind of hate Tennessee, don't you? And so like you want to go around it if you could. Jesus didn't have to go through Samaria. It was very common for Jews in his day. Jews like Jesus, they hated the Samaritans. They hated the area where Samaritans lived. There's deep levels of racial tension. There was a hatred for one another that had lasted for centuries. So they wouldn't go through Samaria. They would go around Samaria. They take the long way. Even though it wasn't easiest, even though it wasn't quickest, even though it wasn't the straightest point from one to the next, they would go around Samaria. Jesus doesn't have to go through Samaria, but he does. He takes the direct route. And John says that he had to. Sounds like he had no choice, right? It's not so much because he was forced. There wasn't anything forcing his hand, and it wasn't because it was the only option. It seems like maybe Jesus had an appointment. It seems like he was compelled. It seems as if Jesus was on the hunt. He's chasing someone down. At the end of the story, it's going to look like grace was on the chase. So Jesus ends up at a well outside of town. He sends the disciples into town for him, and he's sitting there by himself when a woman approaches. This is a strange situation. She shows up in the middle of the day. We're told it's around noon. Women would typically go to the well early in the morning, or they'd go late in the evening when it was cooler. And it's strange that she's walking up alone. That was not normal. Usually women would travel in packs, in groups. There's a loneliness about this woman. They would typically, again, go in packs where they could help one another with the heavy jars. It also added a level of responsibility and propriety to what they were doing. It kind of protected them from some sort of a situation where they could be accused of something that could lead to gossip. It would protect them from being vulnerable. Now, a bad woman, an improper woman, maybe she would show up at the well at the wrong time of the day for an opportunity to do business with a traveling man. This woman shows up at the wrong time, and it makes her look like a bad woman. Now, maybe she isn't. Maybe she doesn't have bad intentions, but at the very least, she's a social outcast. Why is she there alone? Jesus talks to her about water since they're at a well, and it's kind of awkward, kind of a tense conversation. Culturally, she shouldn't have been talking to him, and he shouldn't have been talking to her. And so it kind of feels like tag on the playground, and there's cooties, and we're running away from each other. It's kind of weird, awkward, avoiding type of an interaction. So Jesus kind of wraps it up in verse 16. He says, hey, how about this? Why don't you go get your husband, come back, and we can talk together? And she says, well, I don't have a husband. I think Jesus probably leans in or gets a smirk on his face. I don't know, but he looks at the woman and he says, you're right when you say you don't have a husband. The fact is you've had five men, and the man you now have is not your husband. What you said is quite true. So that's awkward, right? Kind of weird. And it reveals while she was there in the middle of the day, she's embarrassed. Her past is messy, and everybody knows her past. And it's just easier to do life away from everyone than to constantly deal with the looks and the comments. Notice how Jesus doesn't just step away from the truth. He describes the reality of her life and the mess of her life, because grace chases us down, it's true, but grace can't reach us until our brokenness is brought to light. When grace shows up, it confronts our mess. It doesn't just forgive us of our sin and then just try to move us past our mess. It starts by acknowledging and addressing it. It confronts our mess. It doesn't just forget it. Just like what we talked about last week, that as long as I don't see myself as a sinner, as long as I don't see the brokenness of my life, then grace will never seem that good. Sometimes we go to great lengths to cover up our sin. Before we can collide with the grace of God, we got to collide with the truth of our sin. That's what Jesus does with this woman's unique brokenness and her past relationships. He confronts them head on. She's been divorced five different times. Now we hear that, and in our context, it looks like a woman who breaks relationships. She's got some real problems, right? Some of us may even call that a whole lot of sin. Maybe it was. But women didn't really have the opportunity to divorce a man in that culture. It probably means that five different times a man has chosen to leave her, to divorce her. That she's been dumped at least five times. Five different times a man has decided to make her his wife, and then five different times that man has decided she doesn't add value to his life. I think this woman is broken. I think her self-worth is shot. She's worthless, she's useless, she's thrown away in the same way that you would throw away a broken tool around the house. She doesn't do the job, she doesn't meet expectations, and so over and over again, a man decides that he's actually better off without her. And now she's living with number six, and this guy doesn't even think that she's worth marrying. The risk of marrying her isn't worth it to him. Instead of getting into something that he'd likely want to get out of later, he's choosing to simply live with her, which would have been incredibly scandalous. This woman is broken. She's damaged goods. This woman had to have been convinced that she's not loved and that she had zero value, that there's no usefulness to her, that there's nothing desirable about her. And Jesus calls it to light. Now, if you ran into Jesus around the water cooler, what kind of fun, awkward conversations would he have with you? Is he going to mention your sin? Is he going to bring up your brokenness? Maybe he'd say your past relationships prevent you from believing that you have value, and so you sabotage every relationship that you're in. He may say something like your short temper keeps everyone around you on edge, and bitterness towards you is growing in your family. Maybe he'd tell you that your hobby isn't really a hobby, it's actually an addiction, and it's gotten out of control, and it's affecting a lot more people than just you. Maybe he'd tell you that your greatest failure has become your focus, and it's preventing you from moving on. Maybe he'd say you're going deeper into debt to feel better about yourself, and you're not going to find satisfaction there. Maybe he'd tell you that you've given your ears to your friends and they're filling your heads with lies. Maybe he'd say your porn problem is killing any chance of intimacy that you have in your marriage. Maybe he'd tell you that your flirting is leading you down a path that's going to devastate your family, or that you're so desperate for a healthy relationship that you give yourself to anyone who's willing. Or maybe he'd say that you're allowing your heart to fall for a girl who's causing you to fall away from me. Or maybe he'd say you're choosing your live-in boyfriend over your relationship with me. If you were having a casual but awkward conversation with Jesus, and it suddenly turns to your sin or to your brokenness, how would you respond? Last week we talked about our guilt and the things that we do when we're confronted, whenever our guilt becomes the center of attention. And the woman in John 4 does one of the things we talked about last week. She deflects. She basically decides to avoid the conversation and she changes the subject. She shifts the conversation to religion and worship, which is a really strange twist, right? She recognizes that this Jesus guy must be some sort of a holy man, some sort of a prophet, and so she shifts the conversation to the religion and to take the attention off of herself, but she's like out of her league. She doesn't know who she's talking to, and the conversation, like, Jesus goes there. She talks about it, he goes there, and it just gets more and more difficult for her, and I think she starts saying things to get out of the conversation. You ever been there? And so she says to him, I know that the Messiah, the one called Christ, he's coming. And so when he comes, he's going to explain everything to us, which to me sounds a lot like her saying, I don't want to talk to you anymore. I'll just talk to some other guy. When the Messiah shows up, I'll talk to him. That's much easier. But then one of the most spectacular things in Scripture happens. Jesus answers her and says, it's me. I, the one who's speaking to you, I am he. That's fascinating. The first time that Jesus openly and candidly tells someone that he is the Messiah, the first time that he plainly owns the part of who he is, this part, and that he is the Son of God, is to this woman. The first self-acknowledgement that God has finally chosen to move by bringing about the one that has been promised, that a Savior is finally here. The first time the Messiah draws attention to this truth is proclaimed to this woman. He reveals himself to a Samaritan woman with a bad reputation, the one who's been married 5 times and is now living with some other guy. Jesus reveals himself to the woman who just tried to deflect the attention away from her embarrassing brokenness. That's an incredible act of grace. Incredible act of grace. The worst thing that could happen is that you would spend your life trying to outrun God because you think he's chasing you to collect what you owe, when he's really chasing you to give you what you could never afford. Grace is chasing this woman down, and she thought she was caught. And it's nothing but grace. Now, there's a phrase that I've heard a few times with my kids. I've heard it in a couple different environments, people talking socially, and occasionally you're going to hear someone refer to someone else as having main character energy. I don't know if you're familiar with that. The youths are talking like this, okay? And it means that they're talking about someone who carries themselves as if they are the main character. It means they have a self-assured behavior, that they're confident. You've probably seen it. You know this. It's kind of a compliment if you're going to focus on someone's self-confidence, okay, that they're confident. That's a good thing. It's also kind of a critique where you would point out that someone seems to think they're the center of attention and they take it too far, right? They're not as special as they think they are. You know someone who carries themselves like that. They're the main character everywhere that they go. They're the center of attention. They think that the world revolves around them. It's you. Most of us think that we're the main character, and it's easy to do. It's our natural tendency. We naturally are very selfish, and it's easy to think of ourselves and our needs and our wants. It's easy to focus in on the things that bring us joy. It's much more difficult to look outward and focus on the needs of other people. Now, if you take this concept of main character energy and you step that into our relationship with Jesus, it's really easy to think that it's all about me. If you've been in church for a long time, then you've probably heard phrases or statements along lines such as these: Jesus came to save you, or Jesus thought of you on the cross, or that even if you were the only person that needed to be saved, Jesus would have saved you. And I buy those statements, I do. But sometimes we view the story like we're the end of the story. We act like Jesus came to save me, and then that's the end. And if your life is all about you, it's too small, it's too petty. You aren't the center of attention. You aren't the center of the universe. You aren't the only person Jesus is chasing with grace. And I want you to see something really special that happens in this story with the Samaritan woman. Grace chases her down, but it's not just about reaching her. She isn't the only character, and we aren't the only character. We're not even the main character. You might assume, looking at the story, that the woman at the well in John chapter 4, the Samaritan woman, is the focus. That's even how it's going to be titled in your Bible. You're wrong. The story is about Jesus and his grace. He's the main character, and his grace doesn't end with us. It's not the end of the story, because it's not just about you. Go back to the Samaritan woman. You're going to find one of the most unexpected sentences in the entire Bible. From one of the most fascinating statements, it follows one of the most incredible moments of grace where Jesus reveals himself to a woman who has no value. Not my judgment, her judgment. It's how she sees herself. It's how the community sees her. There's nothing about her that suggests she deserves Jesus' consideration. It's an incredible act of grace. And then it's followed by one of the most fascinating, unexpected sentences in the entire Bible. We're told that the disciples show up and then she runs off. Not scared, not fleeing, but something different. She leaves her water jar behind and she takes off because grace intersected with her life. It collided with her life. And she runs from the well and she runs back into town and she begins proclaiming a message to the community. It's wild, right? And you've got to hear this. She's been avoiding talking to these people. And now she's making loud proclamations. She didn't want anyone to see her. She didn't want anyone to notice her. And now she's drawing attention to herself. This woman who's done everything she can to avoid people. She's at a well in the middle of the day, is now running through town, drawing attention. And she has a message. And her message is this. Come and see a man who told me everything I ever did. Samaritan woman didn't want to see other women. She hid from other women in town because it's likely that they knew her story. It's likely that she faced constant judgment. This woman wasn't just an embarrassment. She's worthless and useless and unlovable, just barely above trash. And the people in town thought those things about her, and she thought those things about herself, and then she experiences grace. And she immediately begins drawing attention to herself for anyone who'd be willing to listen to her experience. When she collides with grace, she suddenly sees things differently in her life. She almost blossoms with worth and value and love, and she can't keep it to herself. And even as she draws attention to herself, it's not really about her, it's about Jesus. That message to me is so fascinating. Her message is, come and see a man who told me everything I ever did. Everything I ever did is exactly why she's alone at the well. Because everybody knows everything she ever did. Everything she ever did is exactly what haunts her. It's what prevents her from having community. It's the reason she's at the well in the middle of the day. And now it becomes her celebration. Her message is her brokenness. And her brokenness becomes the way that the rest of the community is drawn towards grace. I want you to see something. Because it's so much bigger than a woman at the well. And it's so much bigger than grace for you. It's the fact that God redeems your brokenness. Grace actually brings value to the pain of your past. Jesus redeems your past, yourself, your self-worth, all for you and for the growth of his kingdom. That word redeem has several ideas tied to it, but one of them is the idea of repairing and restoring. It's what Logan mentioned earlier with barrel staves. It looks like bringing something of value back to life. Taking something that was wasted and useless, suddenly having value. Looks like barrel staves, it looks like tobacco barn wood, right? Stuff that should just be torn down and burned. And somehow making it valuable. Redeem means something had lost value and now value has been restored to it. Jesus chases us with grace and then he takes our past, which looks like a waste. He takes our lives that feel so very broken and useless and it looks like it has no value. And then through grace, Jesus gives our past purpose and meaning and value. Grace brings value to the pain of our past. And it's bigger than just you feeling better about yourself. He isn't just trying to make you feel good. Part of the value that you receive through being redeemed is the ability to pass on grace to the people around you. Because grace is still chasing someone down. And your past and your intersection with grace could be the thing that makes people let grace catch them. Grace is going to chase you down. And then when it finally gets you, you're going to find out that it's kind of like tag, and you're it, and it's like cooties, it's supposed to spread. So even more shocking, I mean, there's just so many things in the story that are so very strange. Even more shocking in the story is that her community listens. And verse 30 says that they came out of town and made their way toward him. A community that avoided a woman and a woman that avoided the community are now walking towards grace together instead of running from it. It's a wild story. What if the story isn't about a Samaritan woman? Remember, we started by saying that Jesus had to go through Samaria and we make it about the woman. But what if it was bigger than that? A few verses later, we're told that many of the Samaritans from that town believed in him because of the woman's testimony, and they repeat it again. He told me everything I ever did. What if Jesus used that woman to save a community? What if Jesus was chasing something bigger than one woman? What if Jesus chased you down, not just for you, but because he's trying to save your family? What if Jesus chased you down, not just for you, but because he's trying to save your neighborhood? What if Jesus chased you down, not just for you, but because he's trying to save your workplace? Jesus wants to reach you, but you aren't the end of the line. The Samaritan woman's story is one of brokenness, and it's known by everyone in our community, and we know it still to this day, and it became core to a message of hope because Jesus is looking for more than just you. He reaches others through your story. So if you have a story and then you meet Jesus, you get Jesus, and your story becomes part of Jesus' bigger story. Your story becomes the story of how grace found you, and it exists for the purpose of drawing others towards God's grace. If you've experienced the grace of God, it's not meant to be kept to yourself. It's not your story now, because Jesus is the main character, and his story is all about a grace that continues to hunt people down. Now, maybe you've never had your interaction with the grace of God. Maybe you're still coming to terms with an idea that a God who knows everything you ever did is the one who's chasing you down, not to make you pay a price, but that he wants to sweep you up in his grace. That's bigger than your sin. His grace is bigger than your brokenness. His grace will pursue you, and it will chase you down, and it won't quit. Some of you in the room need to know that God's grace can redeem your brokenness. You just have to let him catch you. Maybe you've accepted that grace, but you need to have your eyes open to the fact that it isn't just about you. Jesus' grace is bigger than you. When we let Jesus catch up to us, when we let grace catch up to us, it should put us on the hunt for people who haven't been caught by Jesus' grace. Because that's how he changes families, and that's how he changes neighborhoods and schools and workplaces. It's how he changes entire communities. Jesus' grace, communicated through his followers, is how Jesus changed the world, past tense, and it's how he's still changing the world, present tense. God's grace can redeem your family and your friends and your neighbors and your workplace and your community, and you can help them. Your story of grace is now his story. We're going to sing a song here, an opportunity, an invitation for some of you to make a decision. Maybe you've never accepted Jesus, and it's time for you to start that relationship with him and his grace. Maybe today's the day that you stop running so fast and you let him catch you. That'd be cool. Why don't you come up, let's have that conversation, talk about what it looks like to start a relationship with Jesus. Maybe you've let Jesus catch you, but you haven't been very active in trying to catch others. I'd love for you to spend some time praying over the next few moments about the people in your life that you need to catch, the people that you can chase down with God's grace, because it's bigger than you. If you need some prayer, I'd love to pray with you up front. We've got an elder in the prayer room who'd love to pray with you. Don't miss these opportunities. Take them seriously. If you've got a decision to make, let's do it. Why don't you stand? Let's sing.